Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 93-year-old ex-prisoner of war remembers getting shot down on the fifth B-17 mission he flew in World War II, then free-falling blindly through the clouds.
So I said, I'm going to wait until I can see the ground before I open my chute, because otherwise you've got falling airplanes, you've got flak.
He survived all of that, and he'll tell us all about it today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 1059, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every weekend right here. Each week, we visit with veterans, mostly from the World War II generation. The idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way be educated and inspired by members of our greatest generation. We call it Hometown Heroes because no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, there are heroes around you. There are people that have done a lot more than you realize, endured things that maybe you can't even imagine for the sake of our freedom. And no one knows the value of freedom more than those who have had to live without freedom, live in captivity. That's the case today with an ex-prisoner of war that we're going to hear from. 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California is our guest. And I say Bakersfield, California, you've been here a long time, but you grew up in a much colder climate. What was it like growing up in Duluth, Minnesota?
Well, Duluth was a great place to grow up. All sorts of weather and all sorts of things that young kids could do. Skating, skiing, baseball, football, you name it, we could do it. It was a great place to grow up.
Especially with three older brothers who could show you the ropes. You were the youngest of four?
Yes.
And you actually signed up for the military long before Pearl Harbor. When did you first get involved in the service?
Well, I joined the National Guard in Duluth in August of 1936. I was 16 years old, and obviously I had to lie about my age. But that was a great experience. We had summer camps and weekly meetings, and it was a great experience.
So that was your first exposure. And how was it that you aimed toward getting up in the sky and flying a little bit? Did you fly at an early age? Did you see someone else? What got your attention with aviation?
When I was in the Guard, one of my closest friends there was a boy two or three years older than I that was interested in flying. And he got his flying license when he was about 19 years old. And when he hit 20, 21, he joined the Air Force. So about a year before I did. And that was the sort of inspiration to get me to do the same thing.
I'm sure you remember the first time you got up in the air. Do you remember what that felt like? A new feeling for you, I imagine.
My first experience flying was a CAA program that the government ran, I think, particularly to start some initial early training for feeling that the war was going to come and we were going to get involved. So this was in the summer of 1940. And I ended up getting 40 hours of flying time and getting my pilot's license. Could have gone on with that program for another session, but in the meantime, I applied for the Air Force, and I had orders to join the Air Force there in October of 40, so I I obviously passed up the other training. I ended up going to Minneapolis, the army base there, and the six we're talking about were from all over, some from Minnesota, some from the Dakotas, and we all ended up going on a train together and ended up in Oxnard, California as a primary training base.
During the course of all this training, I know it's exciting to be up in the air and experience things you've never experienced before, but were there some challenges along the way? Were there some parts of the training or the studies that you found difficult or tough to get through?
No, not really. I had the fact that I had the 40 hours and a pilot's license before I got there really made an astounding bit of difference. I had no problem. I really enjoyed every bit of the training programs, both, you know, basic and the advanced. It was a great experience.
So as you're progressing along in the training and the flying, did you think about what planes you wanted to fly? Was there some debate in your mind over whether fighters or multi-engine planes would be preferable?
Not particularly. I probably initially felt that I wanted to get into fighters, but, you know, when the training was over with and I was ended up being assigned to the B-17 training, well, that was it. I was happy with it. It was a good training program, and of course I ended up flying every variety of the B-17, including the G that I got shot down in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, they hear B-17, and they have a picture in their mind, and they're all the same, but they weren't all the same. There are a lot of different iterations. Did you have a favorite among the bunch?
Well, the best, of course, was the G, which had the chin turret. The C model was a really early version. It did not have a tail gun. Pretty limited from the standpoint of fighting off anybody else. I'm not sure if the D model had a tail gun or not, but I think it had it was the first one with the lower turret. And then the F model had the upper turret, and I think it had the bottom turret as well as a tail gun.
And they all flew about the same for you? Did they feel the same up in the air?
Oh, pretty much the same. I think the G had a little bit stronger engines than the other, but it was also a heavier airplane, so they all flew about the same.
And having spent as much time as you did and training other people to fly them, what was your opinion on how easy that plane was to fly? Did it take some special skills to handle that big of an airplane, or did you find it fairly simple and straightforward?
Well, I thought it was real easy to fly, probably because I had so much time in it. But it was not a difficult airplane to fly at all, very easy to control. So it's great airplane.
And you alluded to getting shot down. We'll get to that. But chronologically speaking, even still before Pearl Harbor and America's official entrance into the war, you were stationed at Moffett Field, which is up in the Bay Area, where they still have the big blimp hangars. The lighter-than-air program was going up there. And what was it that sent you down to a fateful trip to the Bakersfield area?
Well, the weather was lousy. This is in January of 41. We just couldn't get any flying time in, so we ended up coming down to Bakersfield in order to get some flying time in and finish the basic down here. Meadowfield, I think, was, in fact, it didn't even exist at that time. So we flew out of Meadowfield.
But while you were down here, something else happened that would change your life a little bit. How did you meet your wife?
Well, there was a group of women in Bakersfield that gave periodic dances and get-togethers for the cadets, and then invited, of course, various local girls. And that's where I met my wife.
Well, what was it that caught your eye? Was it the name? Was it the hair? Was it the smile? What do you remember about that?
Oh, it was the look and the smile and everything else. And she always contended that when I and a couple of other guys were walking over to her, she says, "I'm going to take the one in the middle." And that was me.
She had her sights on you. But you weren't here for very long at that time, right?
No, we were just here for a few weeks, about 6 weeks, and we ended up going back to Stockton for the advanced flying before I graduated.
And when you went back up to Stockton, were you thinking you'd ever see her again?
Yes, because I was at Stockton. Fresno is, you know, about an hour's drive away. So I had a couple of dates with her during that 6 weeks at Stockton. But when that was over with, well, I had no idea I'd ever see her again. But course, I ended up being my first assignment out of there was as an instructor, so I ended up back at, by this time, Mentor Field. Obviously, then I had a chance to see her again. She was in her final year at Fresno State.
Yeah, she was a Bulldog. You know, before I forget, I know we're bouncing around time-wise now, but Central California also figured into how you experienced December 7th, 1941. And I like to ask every veteran about Pearl Harbor Day. I've heard a lot of stories, but never had anyone who was where you were at that time. You were going from Bakersfield to San Francisco with an old girlfriend from Minnesota, and you took a little detour through a national park.
On the way, we got the notice that the president was giving a speech, and we were in Yosemite at the time, and pulled over the road and listened to the talk from the president about the beginning of the war.
What did that mean to you? I'm sure there are a lot of things going through your mind at that point.
Well, at that point, the name of the game was to finish driving to San Francisco and dropping off the girl, Minerva. And then I turned around, drove back to Bakersfield.
Did you notice a change in the urgency at that point, now that America was at war?
Well, there was a little bit of increase in the urgency. I'm not sure if we were flying 6 days a week before that, but they juiced up the cadet program training, going a little faster, and probably cut the program by a week or two. And we ended up flying 6 days a week instead of five as instructors. And, you know, that was basically the biggest change.
And we're going to get to the missions you flew, including your last mission and all of that. But have you ever tried to look back and estimate how many other pilots you trained? How many guys went overseas relying on the training they got from you?
Oh, there was a lot. When I got through the B-17 training schedule in the summer of 42, I ended up as an instructor in the B-17 program and ended up doing that for, until the spring of 44. I don't know, I must have trained a couple hundred different pilots and crews, a lot of them. I ended up at Gulfport as a squadron commander. By that time, a training squadron had probably 25 or 30 pilots, an equal number of navigator, bombardier instructors, and gunnery instructors, and the whole thing. I ended up as commander of a couple different squadrons of that before I ended up getting orders overseas.
And those orders overseas, are those something that you had kind of hoped for, waited for you? Were you satisfied with what you were doing domestically, or was there part of you that was itching to get over and fight this enemy?
Well, I was happy with what I was doing, but I knew that, right about the time that I was going to end up with orders overseas. So I was sort of looking forward to it, a little apprehensive at the same time, because my wife was with me, and I'm sure she wasn't going to be very happy, but you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to get to, because a lot of guys decided to get married before they went over, and others said, you know what, let's wait and make sure I actually get back before we do that. Did you guys hem and haw about that at all, or are you just ready to seal the deal and get married before you headed over?
No, we were pretty well set. It had to be in February of 43 that I proposed. Then we got married in that summer.
So what was that like for you to head overseas and leave behind this bride, hoping that you made it back someday?
Well, it was something that I knew was inevitable. Something that you knew was coming and inevitable. It was a little more difficult for her, of course, than it was for me.
And I imagine you carried some items that might remind you of her as you headed off.
Yeah, I had a picture of her with me, which I kept all the time. And when I was a POW, I had it pinned up on the wall next to my bed. I had that picture with me until somebody stole my billfold here a few years ago and never got the picture back.
Boy, that makes everybody angry. That's just despicable. There's some things that are worth a lot more than money, and that's one of them. What about the guys that you went over with? Did you have a crew established before you actually got overseas and flew your first mission? Did you know who was going to be aboard your plane?
No. I had been an instructor for a long time. So when I went overseas, I went over on the premise that I would take over as a squadron commander. because what was happening is as people got 25 missions, they went home. And it only took about 6 months to get 25 missions in. So they were lacking people with a fair amount of experience. So they put together a whole group of majors and lieutenant colonels who had been in the training business for a long time, sent us all over to become squadron commanders with a little bit more experience than the other guys would have.
But they told you before we can make you a squadron commander, you've got to fly 5 missions first? Is that what they said?
Oh, yes. The premise was that the 5 missions were to get oriented with the program, the briefing, the crews, and everything like that, so that by the time you took over as a squadron commander, you had some experience in the area, got to know the crews, got to know the people. So that was the premise of the 5 missions.
So on your 6th mission, you were to take over as squadron commander. But let's talk about your first mission. Do you remember what that felt like to head off on an actual mission with an actual target and 10 guys on your plane that you were just getting to know?
Well, yes, it was a pretty unique experience, obviously. But you were so busy, flying the airplane, handling the crew, getting in formation, staying in formation, and getting prepared to go to the target that, you didn't think too much about it.
And you were flying out of where, England?
Yes, out of a place called Thurlow, which is one of many B-17 bases in England. Thurlow is about a little town about 10 miles from Oxford, which is about 40, 50 miles northwest of London.
And this is the 306th Bomb Group. And having come in after all these planes had been flying for a while, something tells me you didn't get to dub your plane or paint any nose art on it or give it a name. It was probably already done for you, huh?
No, I never had an airplane of my own. Every mission I flew with a different crew. Sometimes I sat in the right seat, sometime in the left. The day I got shot down, I was in the left seat in the... The pilot of this crew sat in the right seat, and it was unfortunate. This was his 25th mission, and he never survived it. He's the only one in the crew that didn't.
Wow. We're going to get that whole story, and I'll see if I can dig a little bit on the other missions, too, with 93-year-old Robert Farwell, originally from Duluth, Minnesota, but a longtime resident of Bakersfield, California, and for a while, an involuntary resident of Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany. What better way to mark Independence Day weekend and the freedom that we as Americans enjoy by listening to someone who experienced the opposite of freedom as a prisoner of war nearly 70 years ago? More of Hometown Heroes right after this. Have you ever been on a submarine? And hanging out with Nemo at Disneyland doesn't count. How about a World War II submarine preserved just as it was in 1945? Well, here's your opportunity, thanks to the Wahoo Base Submarine Veterans. On Saturday, July 13th, you can tour the World War II sub USS Pompanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime Museum. I'm planning to be on the bus, but more importantly, we'll have veterans on the bus who actually served on subs just like the Pompanito. It's a chance to experience history in a very unique way, and you'll also have 5 hours on your own in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf area. The bus will leave Fresno at 7 a.m. on July 13th, 0700 for you veterans. We'll roll back into Fresno at approximately 9 p.m. or 2100. Ready to reserve your seat? Call Ted Dick at 559-834-2191. That's 559-834-2191. You can't see a World War II sub every day, so let's go explore some history together July 13th.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California. We heard him share that after training hundreds of bomber pilots in the States, he went overseas to start flying bombing missions himself. Right before we left off, we heard him mention being shot down in his B-17 on his fifth mission. We're going to get to that, but first,
on your first four missions, was there anything that happened that kind of gave you an inkling of how dangerous this was going to be and how possible getting shot down or having it end that way was going to be? Did you face a lot of flak in those first four missions?
Yeah, not as much as later on, because the first two missions were targets in southwestern Germany. So we flew, actually, you flew most of the time over France, which was occupied by then turned into Germany, and we were probably only in Germany on these missions for about an hour. And the first two missions, the next two were to Schweinfurt, which was pretty much in the middle of Germany. And when you were in Germany, you were getting flak all the time. There was just, I never flew a mission that I didn't have holes in the airplane when I got back.
I don't want to miss anything in those first four missions before your fifth when you were shot down. Were there some moments along the way with that flak hitting the plane and you can hear it and you can feel it that you were a little concerned that you might not make it back?
Well, I don't think I ever thought you wouldn't make it back. It didn't occur to you. But when you could hear sometimes when the flak was hitting, but you didn't give you were so busy just flying and flying formation and trying to keep track of where you are that you didn't pay much attention to it.
And I've had this discussion so many times with so many pilots, but for some of our listeners, I don't think they understand that you can't dodge flak. You can't try to bend the plane this way and that to get out of the way. You got to fly right through it and stay in formation, right?
Yeah, that's right. You just fly the airplane and hope you don't get hit.
And when you would make it home from one of those missions and you'd bring the plane in safely and your crew is off the plane and you're back in your bunk trying to sleep that night, what kind of thoughts would go through your mind? I mean, are you breathing a sigh of relief? Or are you saying a prayer? Are you looking at your wife's picture? What do you think that was like?
I think probably you just felt a little bit of sort of relief that that day was over with. You thought about the mission and what was going on, anticipating more of it. But it was more of an excitement than concern.
So let's talk about your fifth and final mission of World War II. When this was September of 44, is that right?
Yes, September 12th, I think.
And where were you supposed to go?
The mission was an industrial complex that was about 80 miles southwest of Berlin. So we had to fly out over the North Sea, come in over eastern Germany, and fly down. We probably flew about 40 to 50 miles west of Berlin. And just as we were past Berlin, probably about 60 miles from the target. Of course, we were flying in flak all the time. And then about that time, our fighter escort left. And as soon as they left, we got jumped by a bunch of F-190s, and I think that's what ended up hitting our airplane.
And had you faced opposing fighters before, or was that the first time?
No, actually, that's the first time, because in the other missions, we had fighter escort, and a lot of them were over a part of Germany that we were occupied, and by this time the Germans were a little bit short of fighter pilots, so they didn't tangle with anything they just stayed back, and they would just they would then only hit the bombers after the our fighter escorts left.
So how did that unfold for you? You're up there in the left seat in the cockpit flying this plane, and did someone see something? Did you see the fighters coming? How did you realize you were under attack?
Oh, yeah, we saw them coming. We were flying, in, of course, in formation. I was leading the upper sixth element of the group. Gee, there were several groups. I'm not sure just how many airplanes in all that were going on that mission. Quite a bunch. We were in the lead group. We just ended up getting the head-on attack from the fighters. You know, it's just the way it was.
So you're looking out the front of the cockpit, and you see an FW-190 flying straight at you.
Four of them. Yeah, we can see them coming. There's nothing you can do about it. We've got a turret gunner, and the bombardier handles the lower turret. And, of course, we're shooting at them while they're shooting at us. And, you know, that's just the way it goes.
When you see those four planes coming at you, do you even have time to think? Do you have that moment where your heart sinks down into your stomach? I mean, what was that like?
No, you just plunge ahead. You can see them coming, but there's nothing you can do about it, except you've got guys on your side that are shooting at them, and you're so busy you don't worry about anything else.
So what happened to your airplane? How much damage did they inflict?
Well, we got hit right in the cockpit, started a fire. So obviously, what the shots did was go right into the cockpit area, and it broke the propellers on a B-17 are operated with oil pressure. And then, of course, you've got oxygen lines all over. So what happened when it hit in front of the cockpit, it started a fire because it broke the oil lines and severed the oxygen lines. You know, the whole cockpit was on fire. So I motioned to the co-pilot. In the meantime, the bombardier and the navigator came out from below. I motioned for the co-pilot, you know, to get out. We pulled the hatch in there because my number three engine was hit too. So it was burning. So everybody bailed out. The co-pilot was first, then the bombardier and the navigator, then my engineer who was manning the top turret. And when they were all gone, then I went out. In the meantime, the gunners in back, the tail gunner and the two side gunners bailed out too.
You talk about the cockpit being on fire, and you're describing it very calmly and matter-of-factly, but it sounds like absolute chaos. Could you see anything in there?
Well, after a while, a lot of the smoke cleared. By the time I went to bail out, I think basically the fire was probably substantially depressed, because by the time the oil and the oxygen got together and that was burned off, there wasn't much else going on. The biggest problem then is the fire on the number three engine. Anyway, it was time to get out of the airplane.
And as you did exit that airplane, knowing the rest of your crew has already jumped off and you're bailing out, what did you see? What was the scene in front of you? Because you talked about how many planes were in this formation. What did you see as you bailed out?
Well, I knew that there was a lot of flak. There was a lot of any airplanes. There was a lot of metal flying around. So I said, I knew that we'd been briefed that the cloud formation, the tops were at about 18,000, and the bottom of the formation was at about 4,000. So I said, I'm going to wait until I can see the ground before I open my chute, because otherwise you've got falling airplanes, you've got flak all over the place. So when I got down to the point where I was just ready to come out of the clouds at about 4,000 feet, then I pulled the ripcord and the parachute took me down.
All right, I always try to imagine myself in the situation that the veteran is experiencing here, and this has got to be right up there with some of the scariest. In my mind, you're free-falling blindly through clouds for 14,000 feet.
From 28,000 to 4,000 feet, whatever that is.
24,000 feet, free-falling without seeing anything, really.
No, I was in the clouds.
What in the world is going through your head?
I was waiting to see the ground.
Were you scared at all?
Not really. You don't have time to get scared. You're just figuring what do you have to do? What do you do? What are you going to do? Where's the ground? And that's about it.
So you pull your chute, and then I imagine everything slows down a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. By the time the chute opens and everything's calmed down, you're probably at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And fortunately, I'm about 40 miles just east of Berlin, and it's just farm country. And I'm floating down there looking at a hayfield, level and flat. When I'm at about 1,500 feet, I see a farmer with a pitchfork running towards where I'm going to be landing. And as I landed, he's there right with me. So there was no evasion, no escape, no nothing. So as the saying goes, for you, the war is over.
Did he actually say that to you?
They did. A couple of guys did.
I don't know if I've met a POW yet, at least in Europe, who wasn't told those specific words. And I imagine because you were the last one out of the plane and the plane's still moving, you're quite a ways from any of those other guys from your crew.
Yeah, I couldn't. There was nobody else near me that I could see. And, of course, we're not the only airplane. There was 12 Air B-17s shot down that day on that mission. I'm not sure how many airplanes there were on the mission, but, a couple hundred anyway. And 12 got shot down.
So the farmer with the pitchfork captures you and then turns you over to whom?
Well, there was a flak station about, probably a half mile from where I landed. He took me there, and the flak guys were pounding themselves on the back. They asked me, I said, how'd you get shot down? And I says, well, I don't know. I said, we were being attacked by fighters, and there was flak all the way. I don't know which one hit us. They all said, we did. Yeah, they took credit for it.
And you weren't injured in any way, weren't hit, weren't burned, nothing?
I had a helmet on and glasses, so my eyebrows were burned, and I had just flesh wounds, just kind of like sunburn on the part of my face that wasn't covered by an oxygen mask. Nothing serious.
I know it's a long time ago, and so much has happened since then, but if you can put yourself back in that position and now you're a prisoner of the Germans, what do you think your expectation was for what the future held for you?
Well, I knew that it would, if I survived to get to one of the prison camps, that we'd survive all right, because the Germans were treating the prisoners pretty much according to as close to the Geneva Convention as they could. Because there was a lot of German prisoners, airmen in prison camps in the UK and in the US. So they wanted to do the best they could to protect the integrity of their own prisoners, making sure that they got treated well, too.
At this point, we're still a few months away from everything that Piper pulled around the Battle of the Bulge and the Malmedy Massacre and all that. So what did they do with you? They stick you on a 40 and 8 and train you somewhere, or what?
Well, we ended up, as I say, in this flak outfit. They had a sort of a cellar jail that they put me in. I was in there probably until about 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. So that was probably 6 or 8 hours or something like that. And then I think he was the mayor of the little town around there. And he came with a car that had a rumble seat in it. It was a Mercedes Roadster with a rumble seat. So I got in the rumble seat with a German GI who was a guard. In the meantime, the Brits were bombing the place. And we drove to a place where bombs had hit an apartment building, and the place was on fire. There were people all over the place, screaming and yelling, and the building was burning, and the mayor stopped there and was parked. And I guess consoling people and just seeing what was going on. And then some of the people noticed me and started coming forward, and the guard that was in the rumble seat with me stood up and told the people to back off, that I was a prisoner. They were taking me. So after maybe 30 minutes, we got back in the car, and drove for 30, 40 minutes and stopped at a place, basically a train station. The German guard and I got off there and waited for a train, probably like a trolley, a commuter train of kind. So we got on it, and it was pitch black. There were no lights, and the place was crowded. We stood up. We were on that for about 10 minutes, then it stopped. RAF was bombing the place. So we stopped there probably for, 15 or 20 minutes. And when the bombing was over with, we then continued probably for about another 20 minutes, got off the train. We were right at the gate of Templeton Airport. The German soldier brought me in there, and I joined 50 or 60 American prisoners that were already there, because we lost a lot of airplanes. And all of my crew was there except the co-pilot.
And the co-pilot was the only one from your crew, as you mentioned, who didn't survive. We'll explore that and touch on Mr. Farwell's experience as a prisoner of war after this break. You can find some photos of Mr. Farwell then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking this time with 93-year-old B-17 pilot and ex-prisoner of war, Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, originally from Duluth, Minnesota. And where we left off in his World War II story, he was in Germany, shot down in his B-17, captured. And we just heard about when he was taken to a location where 50 or 60 other POWs were there. He found all but one member of his crew there. And I know you hadn't known any of these guys very long at all, but I have to imagine it meant something to you to see some familiar faces and also know that these men you felt responsible for had actually survived.
Well, it was a relief to see them, realize that they had got out and landed safely and were in good hands, like I say, except the co-pilot.
When did you find out what happened to him?
Well, after the capture, we ended up on a train to Oberursel, which was an interrogation center, then for about a week, then to a place called Wetzlar, which was a place where all of the Air Force prisoner of war ended up as a sort of a distribution center. And after about a week there, you were either sent to Stalag Luft 1 or Stalag Luft 3. Like I say, all of the crew except the co-pilot. About 6 weeks later, a young captain that was in the bed next to me came into the camp. And when he saw me, he said, "Who is the first man out of your airplane?" I said, "The co-pilot." And he said he fell out of his chute. And that's the first time I knew what happened to him. It was a tragedy.
And when you hear something like that, do you say, that could have been me? That could have happened to any of us, the way it happened to him?
Well, it could, but in the routine, normally flying, like in the States when you're doing training, you unhook the leg straps on your parachute because they're confining. But in the wartime situation, you know, you don't do that. What happened is the co-pilot did that. So he bailed out without his leg straps on. Now, I didn't know that until I found out he fell out of his chute. And, of course, obviously that's what he did. He was flying without his leg straps. And he went to bail out. He forgot about it, unfortunately.
And you said that was his 25th mission and he would have gotten to come home?
Yeah, that was his 25th mission. And if he'd had his leg straps buckled, he would have made it. Tragedy.
And you mentioned interrogation, and I've heard a lot of different kinds of stories about those interactions with the Germans, and it seems everyone was a little surprised by how well, A, the Germans spoke English, and how much they knew about you. Is that what you found?
Oh, yeah. When we got to Oberursel, which was where they did the interrogations, we just spent a couple of days in there in solitaire, nobody talking to you. And you're wondering what's going to happen next. And then you start in the interrogations. And, of course, the first thing you do is, you know, your instructions are don't tell them anything. But after the first couple, 3 days, or maybe about the fourth or fifth day, when I go in for about my third interrogation, the German, the captain that was interrogating me, told me where I graduated from flying school, where I was born and raised, what group I was with. In fact, he even told me the bed that I slept in my barracks in England. So they had an awful lot of information on people.
That sounds like it had to be pretty mind-blowing for you to realize that.
It was, and of course that's a technique they use to get you to figure that they know everything anyway, you know. Then it's something to get you to talk. Of course, I'd only been in England for about 5 weeks, and hell, I couldn't tell them anything that they didn't know anyway, and they soon figured that out.
So, shot down in September of 44, and interrogated, taken to the prison camp, Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany, near the Baltic Sea. As I try to, again, imagine myself in your shoes, it seems like a pretty uncertain future. How did you deal with that, with not knowing how long the war's going to last, with if you're ever going to be free again, if you're ever going to see your wife again? How did you cope with all of that?
Well, we were very confident. Actually, when I got to Stalag Luft 1, the war on the ground had been going pretty well. And I thought, well, it's no problem. We'll be home by Christmas. We all felt that the war was going in the right direction, and that it would end soon. Of course, as we got close to Christmas, that's when they had there was a big Battle of the Bulge, I think they called it, and it became pretty apparent that we were going to be there a little bit longer. But we were confident, absolutely, that we were going to get out of there in not too far distant future. You know, as the months went on, and it got into April and May, we knew the war was coming to an end. Our spirits were pretty good. We were confident we'd be out of there shortly, and of course we were.
And I'm guessing you knew that not because of what you were hearing from the guards and from the Germans. I'm sure they had a very different story to tell you about what was unfolding in the war. How did you get the truth?
Somewhere along the line, we had a hidden radio. And the way it got there is that various people on crews all had radio parts in their chutes and on their person. so that over time, enough of that got through that we had a radio that could listen in and get BBC. And with that information, the guys that worked in the administrative quarters ended up publishing a one-sheet newsletter every day that was passed from compound to compound. And then it got passed from building to building and room to room. So that sometime every day we got a piece of news that was from our side and not from the Germans.
And I'm sure the Germans were intent on confiscating that radio when they figured out you had one, huh?
Well, I think they knew that we had that, but I don't think they ever found it. To the best of my knowledge, I'm not just sure where we hid the thing, but there were people in each barracks and in each compound that were responsible for it. But to the best of my knowledge, I think the Germans knew that we had something going on, but I don't think they ever found one. At least not that I know about.
And did you ever have things that you needed to hide from the Germans? If so, how'd you do that?
Well, I never had anything I had to hide from them. Never got anything. People did, though. There were things going on. In fact, each barracks and so on had certain people. In fact, my roommate, Jerry Johnson, was the group intel officer, and he was privy to all the stuff that was going on. We had a lot of information that the Germans never knew we had. They suspected that there was a lot going on, but I don't think they ever found anything.
One of the other common themes that I end up discussing with every prisoner of war I've encountered is the diet and the weight loss. Now, you were a pretty big, strong guy. I've seen these photos of this bomber pilot. How much did you weigh when you were captured?
Oh, I probably weighed about 185.
And how hard was it to get used to the food you got in Stalag Luft 1?
Well, the Germans gave you enough to barely keep you alive, but we got what we call Red Cross parcels, which were furnished by the U.S. government, and by agreement with the Germans, were delivered to Switzerland and to Sweden. And then the arrangement with the Germans were that they could let those red parcels into us, and we generally got one a week. Basically, that's what kept us alive, because our ration from the Germans was like a potato and a cup of barley a day, and that was it. We'd have starved if it hadn't been for the Red Cross parcels. We still all lost weight. When the war ended, I was probably down to about 155.
And that's not bad compared to some of the other extreme cases I've heard about. And you mentioned the Red Cross parcels. I'm sure that makes you a fan of the Red Cross still today. But what about the bread? You didn't say anything about the bread. Everyone tells me about the sawdust bread. Did you chip a few teeth on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got that piece of bread every day.
How hard was it? I've heard differing stories of how much was flour and how much was tree flour in the sawdust.
Yeah, I think it was probably about a quarter to a third sawdust. But, you know, we were so short of food, we ate it anyway. But if we had to depend on that and an occasional potato, we'd have all starved to death.
And what was it that kept you thinking positive, believing that you're going to come out of it? Where do you think that spirit, that mindset came from for you?
Well, we were confident, absolutely, that we were overcoming them, that the Germans were on the run. And I guess part of it was because of this, radio we had and the little newspaper that got circulated, so that we were pretty well aware of how the war was going. So we were confident that we were going to get out of there, before long.
And I saw in your scrapbook a postcard that you sent to your wife. Did you ever get any mail from her? Did you have any idea whether she knew you were alive or dead or safe or anything?
Yes, I got the only letter I got there was from her sister. So she told me that they had received initially a letter that I was shot down, and then a few weeks later that I was a POW. And got an address that way she could write to. And I got that letter from her sister In the meantime, my wife wrote a letter to me, I guess every day, never got one. But when the war was over with, they were all sent back. And I don't know, God, there must have been 50 of them. And I read a lot of them when I was back home.
And before we get to you getting back home, if you spent all those months, 8 months as a prisoner of war, what was the hardest thing for you? What was the toughest thing to endure and overcome?
Oh, gee.
Because listening to you, it doesn't seem like it bothered you all that much. I don't know how much of that is time that's passed, but back then, I mean, you're still a pretty young guy, and this is some pretty tough stuff, it seems to me.
Well, the big thing is we were absolutely confident that the war was going in our direction and that we'd be out of there. We didn't know exactly when, but, well, initially when I got shot down, I thought I'd be home by Christmas, as I told you. So as things got a little bit grimmer, we realized that we were going to be there for a while, but we were confident that it wouldn't be too long, you know, that sometime in the spring or summer, this thing was going to be over with. You know, it was. We were right. The timing was a little off.
How was that Christmas, by the way? Christmas in captivity?
Well, that's no fun. You know, quite a few of the guys had been there long enough that they got parcels, you know, through the mail, through the Switzerland and Sweden. A lot of them had food packages like cake mix and, you know, stuff like that you could use. So one of the guys in our group had some of that, and we ended up making a cake.
No sawdust in that, right?
No sawdust in it. It wasn't much, but it was a break to have it, and a feeling that we've got something going here.
Boy, how much do so many of us take for granted, huh? We're out of time today for this episode of Hometown Heroes, but there is a lot more to Mr. Farwell's story, so we're going to pick it up again next time. Thanks to this 93-year-old ex-prisoner of war for helping to remind us so powerfully that freedom is not free.